Call to order.
Call to order.
Your call to order.
Very good. I'll do the roll call.
Roll call.
Susan Fowler. Tom Moore. Joe Omonosage.
Here.
Elaine Palencia.
Here.
Kyle Patterson.
Here.
Julian Rappaport.
Here.
Jane Sprandel.
Here.
Kathleen Worth Couch.
Here.
And John Paul Joachim. We have a quorum.
Good. So, citizen input, public participation. So, who's ready to?
None.
Anybody for citizen input or participation? Okay. Approval of agenda. So moved.
Or discussion.
A discussion of the agenda. Yeah, there's a revised one.
The revised agenda has been merged with the extra packets with the online version, and then there's a loose copy here, but it simply adds an item to the very end of the meeting. Otherwise, it's the same.
I don't have any comments. Voice vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Executive director.
Oh.
I have no comments today. Okay.
I do have a few comments, and I wrote them down so that they won't take very long. The annual expo event is scheduled for Saturday, March 28th from 9 to 2. Sponsorship and exhibitor information is due this Friday, so if you're still thinking about it, contact Barb Bresner or Jim Mayer. Their information's on the website, or I can give it to you after the meeting. We also still need volunteers. The Ebert Fest is close to finalizing an anti-stigma film for us. The first one they considered has fallen through, and they've offered another one which has a focus on trauma and resiliency. I watched it the other day. I think there's a lot of potential for us. They'll bring the director to town on the Friday of the festival, and Chandra will set up a high school screening and discussion with the director, and it's totally appropriate for young people to see. So that'll be Friday the 17th of April, and that's probably the day that it will be shown in the festival too. We'll do the art show on Saturday, April 18th, and somewhere in there will be a panel discussion, and we're developing promotions. And I'll try to keep everybody in the loop on those things, but sometimes I create emails that are way too big. I apologize. I know it must be annoying, but I want you all to have a chance to see those. Watching some federal legislation of interest that's related to the workforce shortages, especially in behavioral health. Also related to expanded access to behavioral health care, including in infant pediatric settings, and also for expansion of Medicaid and other coverage for people while they're in prison and jail and just prior to their release, which would save counties $70 billion and maybe provide more coordinated care. That's an issue that we have worked carefully with the sheriff's office over many years to try to put some coordination to the care. It's a challenge. It'd be really great if Medicaid was fixed. So I'll be attending some NACO health steering committee meetings and healthy county meetings and a Hill briefing on healthcare in jails in 2 weeks. And then I'm also going to the NACBID legislative and policy conference while I'm out there. So I'll bring you back 40 pages of notes or something like as quickly as possible from that, I promise. We're also tracking some state legislation, which is exciting, but maybe doomed. It proposes to increase the wages for people who do IDD services by 20%. This is really important. It would also hold those wages 145%, at least 145% over minimum wage from now on. So it's great. It's much needed. 75% of those additional funds have to be used on staff, and the rest could go to admin and overhead if that's the desire of the provider agency. The big problem is it's $267 million more than the Department of Human Services Division of DD actually has. So we'll see what happens. I'm going to keep pushing for it anyway. They've got to find the money. To just a quick review of the agenda, the first parts of our meeting tonight are probably the most exciting, and those are the mid-year progress reports from two agencies on three programs, and they've provided some additional documents that are on the table in front of you and also at the end of the table. Then there's a maybe not as exciting but important update on the property tax case ruling and the impact. I have just a brief comment to add to that. It's for information only. Then my favorite, the list of applications for funding for the next cycle. And here are a bunch of paper copies of applications if you decide that you want to review them in the same way you have for the last couple of years. And that's something you might want to discuss. Then we have Pat Egge is here, and hopefully we'll get to this point before she has to leave. She has an update on the family model planning process and the ARC trainings. You have some handouts for those too. There's a memorandum from me on, it's an update on agency financial assurances and some of the supports that we're trying to provide, especially to smaller agencies, to help them with compliance with that. We also have the updated funding guidelines there. And the registration form. I took a closer look at all of that, and I think it's too soon to judge whether the new rules are helping or not. Then meeting schedules with a little bit different date for July. Then I can give you DD board input. And then we have staff reports, board-to-board reports, and board announcements. And then, importantly, we need to have a brief closed session, and that's the difference between the original agenda and the amended agenda. And I have also had several different iterations of the right language and finally got it from the main source. So we have the right language for going into that session, and then we'll adjourn after that. So that's what I've got. Thanks.
So any new business? Champaign County Regional Planning Office, Planning Commission?
Good evening. Is this on? I am Lisa Benson. I'm the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission Community Services Director. And Thomas is here with us tonight. He's actually going to be primary to the presentation, so I'll let him introduce himself and get started. I'm here for moral support and to throw in a little bit of commentary here and there.
Thank you. Can you hear me appropriately? Okay. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to come and talk about some of the work that we're doing. I'm really happy to be here. Can we put that into slideshow? So I'm going to talk about the Homeless Service System Coordination Program, which is our strategic efforts to strengthen the Champaign County continuum of service providers to the homeless. Go to the second slide, please. So the continuum is the HUD continuum of care for Champaign County. Our mission is to end homelessness in Champaign County through a coordinated network of resources for individuals and families who are homeless or at risk of becoming homeless. As the coordinator of that, my work really is to support the executive committee in overall system coordination to make sure that we're in compliance with the HEARTH Act, and overall to try to improve outcomes for those who are currently experiencing homelessness. Goal number one of the HSSC program is to improve our members' understanding of the CSPH mission. We held the new member orientation back in October to the full CSPH board. In our post-orientation survey, members, respondents to the survey reported Their understanding of both our mission and their agency's role in our mission had improved. 70% of respondents reported that. Additionally, 80% of respondents reported improvements in their understanding of the HEARTH Act. Next, the Homeless Emergency Assistance and Rapid Transition to Housing Act, which is what governs continuum of care programs nationwide. In the months following the orientation, I met one-on-one with staff from various agencies within the CSPH. I did that to help review the orientation and the mission, and also to answer any questions and seek feedback on how we can improve the orientation. Goal number two of our program is to improve our knowledge of local, state, and federal resources that are available to us. So through that, I have attended a number of webinars and conference calls, especially for the statewide continuum of care conference call that happens quarterly. And I've also been on calls with our technical assistance providers. I also attend a number of webinars, mostly from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, dealing with topics such as the Notice of Funding Availability, which is the big grant competition that funds the COC, the Assistance Performance Measures, our Homeless Management Information System, Coordinated Entry, and a couple of other topics. I also participate in some in-person conferences and trainings, such as the HUD Annual Grantee Meeting and the census trainings that are going on currently. Our third primary goal has been to strengthen the membership through coordinated trainings. Back in October, we held the new member orientation. In December, I presented a fair housing and non-discrimination training that I had developed. And yesterday, we held a VI Spadat training. The VI Spadat is a survey that plays a pretty instrumental role in our coordinated entry system, which is a system that sort of serves to route everyone experiencing homelessness to the most appropriate resource that's available to them. We had 19 people attend that. Our overall goal for this was to have 40 people attend trainings. Right now, we're at 59. Over the 3 months, I completed the 22 one-to-ones, and other than just reviewing the orientation, I also sought to identify agency interests in the work of the CSPH, their experience, and their needs. I think the one-to-ones are really critical because it helps us to build our overall capacity, broker relationships, and things like that. In that same vein, to increase our capacity, I've conducted a couple community outreach events. The Community Coalition, back in November, I presented to a room full of about 80 people, which was quite the experience. We talked about the point in time, which I'll talk about more later, and gave a brief overall introduction to the continuum's work. Then I participated as part of a homeless services panel at the Human Service Council and came to our local area network meeting to talk about the point in time. Another important part of my job is to make sure that the members who already come to the CSPH meetings remain engaged. Following the orientation and our one-to-one series, we saw 7 agencies either start coming to the CSPH for the first time or express a renewed commitment to come after a period of absence. Agencies in that group would include the CU Public Health District, the Developmental Services Center, and CU RACES. We also welcomed one new agency into the CSPH, which was First Followers. They signed an MOU membership agreement in July. Oh, you want to talk about the attendance? Sorry. The graph on the screen shows attendance to the CSPH meetings in January of 19 and January and February of 2020. There aren't many months currently that are directly comparable before and after my start date. January has a pretty mild 5% increase in attendance from 19 to 20. February, we see better results with a 35% increase in agency representation in February of 2020. On January 30th, we completed our point in time count. That is a count that's mandated by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. We really have to do it every year, and it helps us get a complete snapshot of everyone who's experiencing homelessness on a single night. We're required to do it in the last 10 days of January. This year, thanks to some outreach efforts, we had a really great volunteer turnout. We had 26 people come out on a cold night to give up their time to count people experiencing homelessness on the streets. Last year, in 2019, we had 16 volunteers. To make sure those volunteers were prepared for collecting surveys and interacting with people in vulnerable situations, we conducted 2 point-in-time trainings, and those covered the survey that we developed and just how to interact with people professionally. We completed 13 surveys that night, and following some deduplication efforts, our final unsheltered count is 8 individuals, which is roughly in line with what we anticipated. Final results, which will be inclusive of both the unsheltered and sheltered persons experiencing homelessness, will be finalized no later than April 2020. The Fox Illinois News also covered the event. They interviewed myself and a couple of our volunteers. We have a clip of that. It's only about 2 minutes long. We're going to try and show it. Hopefully our audio can work.
Champaign County. Their mission? To count the number of people experiencing homelessness. Fox Illinois' Lauren Kostick caught up with the volunteers before they went out. She explains why this data is so important. Lauren?
Well, Brianna, technically it's a government requirement, but it also gives us a snapshot of what homelessness looks like here in Champaign County. Then that data is likely to get more services for those living on the streets.
I think it's incredibly important to make sure we count as many people that are out there as we can find.
Thomas Bates is the coordinator for the Champaign County Continuum Service Providers for the Homeless. He and more than 30 volunteers went out Thursday to count the number of people without a home.
So in the last few months, I have coordinated with different agencies, law enforcement, things like that, to make sure that we're hitting everywhere that we're forcing.
Last year, the group counted 2 people unsheltered and 149 sheltered. That's compared to the 9 and 179 people in 2018. That data is based off one night in January.
If they're staying in a vehicle in a place not meant for human habitation, that qualifies them as literally homeless.
Each group of volunteers is assigned an area and given a list of questions.
We're going to be operating in groups of 4 to 5. We've got 7 different teams hitting the entire county.
Julie Carlson and Ashley Salinetro were both assigned downtown Champaign.
Kind of be a friendly face and really try to understand the situation and hope that we get some really good data tonight from that.
That data collected grant money. Last year, Champaign County received more than $700,000 to help with services. And we also went downtown to ask those on the street what services they would like to see. Some or sleeping, and many others were already sheltered.
And it is our job to count them and make sure that they receive the services that they need.
And volunteers wrapped up about an hour ago. I'm told we will not be able to see the results of the survey for about a few weeks. So we're able to give small gift cards to the people they met tonight. Live in Champaign, I'm Lauren Kostick. Back to you.
Thanks.
Health and safety. There's a second wave of the flu in the U.S., and its threat is more harmful than the first half.
Sorry about the audio problems there. Hopefully that gives you an idea of the kind of work that we put into the point in time to make sure that we had quality results from it. This is some historical data going back to 2017. Like she said in the report, last year we found 2 people unsheltered. I would condition that by saying that the weather last year was incredibly intense. It was 13 degrees and snowy, and on the sign-in sheet, they actually had written it felt like -5 degrees. So it was a pretty intense count last year. I hope that answers some questions, but I'm more than happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, so this may be a whole nother presentation, but so at this point, we're looking at about 8 unsheltered individuals. What is kind of the reasoning behind them maybe not going to a sheltered place? I have my thoughts, but I guess I'd like to know the true data.
As far as true data, I can report my anecdotal experience. It can be a number of things. There is a really limited amount of emergency shelter capacity. Austin's place has 14 beds available for women, and I think men's emergency shelters are operated by CU at Home has 50 with an overflow of 20, I think. There are also people who keep in mind that people experiencing homelessness tend to be highly vulnerable. They have trauma. They have different things going on. Some people may simply be more comfortable in a place that they feel they have more control over. I don't really want to give reasons. I don't want to speak for people beyond that.
I think you covered it well. We definitely, I believe that we do have a good amount of capacity for the individuals, but there's always self-choice, and some people decide not to partake in the shelters. They would have to speak to their individual reasons.
Is there a list of the agencies that are a part of this consortium? Do we have that?
Yes. I believe it's on our website also. It's on the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission website, and there is a specific tab, we'll say, for the Council of Service Providers to the Homeless, and all the members and affiliates are listed. So, and we can provide that to you if you'd like.
Well, yeah. if you decide that you want to review applications in the way that you have done for the last couple of years, you would just happen to be the primary reviewer of this program, and that is listed in their application.
Well, that's great. Thank you. I have one other question, if I may. What happens to the $700,000 that come from the feds? How does that money get used?
It supports homeless assistance programs. The majority of the money goes into permanent supportive housing vouchers. There are funds that support continuum of care planning, and there are funds that support a centralized intake project.
So you distribute that those funds? Is that, or do they just pass through you?
So
how does that work?
That is, the Housing Urban Development actually is the grantor. They're federal grants, and they are direct recipients. So as a continuum, we apply, and we have to put in the application, but then HUD does direct grants to the recipients of funds.
So it goes directly to the housing authority?
So currently, as we sit here today, the current recipients are Regional Planning Commission, and Rosecrans receives a permanent supportive housing grant.
Okay, thank you.
Can you just walk through the graph? What is sheltered ES versus sheltered TH? And I was just wondering, was there a reason why there's only 3 years of data versus more?
Sheltered ES is emergency shelter. Those are people who are currently staying in our emergency shelter programs. Sheltered TH is transitional housing. It's a place where essentially people can stay a slightly longer amount of time, but they still meet federal definition of HUD homelessness. So we include them in this count. We include the 3 years of data simply because 3 years is good to illustrate. We have data going back 2005.
We have data going way back. I know I regularly put a grid together for Mark specifically. He goes, I think I started back then with 2014. We've had some significant changes, honestly, that probably started in 2015, 2016 with transitional housing loss. So some of that, honestly, was one of those things that you guys would have been like, what's that about? And we'd have to go into this long discussion. So this was partly on my part. I said, let's start with 2017 because there was some consistency beginning in 2017 with the housing beds that we had. The sheltered emergency shelter and transitional housing, this is the data that is specific to Housing Urban Development and what they want and what they compare nationwide for those that are sheltered. When we talk about sheltered homeless, so these individuals are still considered homeless because they're in emergency shelter and transitional. They're not permanently housed. So when we count individuals and families, we don't consider them housed. They still remain homeless as as long as they're in emergency shelter and transitional housing.
So yeah, the reason why I was asking was it seemed that the transitional housing decreased in the last 3 years. You said it went down in 2015, we lost some transitional housing?
Particularly when the Time Center closed, we lost transitional beds. We've had other losses in transitional housing over the years. That is partly, I mean, there's many factors. One of those is federally, they stopped investing in transitional housing. And then also the state budget crisis impacted some of our human services also in that arena. I think there's other things that other people can think of too. Those are the two that come to mind specifically.
Okay. I mean, the question I was wondering was, because the homelessness is the homeless total homeless that we have over the last 3 years is pretty stable, but the transitional housing has decreased. Do you feel like that we're just transitioning people into more long-term housing better, or we just don't have as much transitional housing? Even in the last 3 years, we don't have as much that we can fill the capacity of what we need, and it's just we're not seeing an increase in the total homelessness so far, but there is a need for that increase in transitional housing.
I do believe that we're doing better recently, particularly moving people into permanent housing. I think we've made many strides, even with our local housing authority, in creating partnerships and developing more permanent housing for individuals and being able to move them from emergency shelter to permanent housing, avoiding shelter, you know, through rapid rehousing. There's also investment in doing exactly that, you know, instead of going to a shelter, doing what we can to avoid homeless prevention and rapid rehousing. So, and with the focus and investment on permanent housing, there is more vouchers for homeless individuals to be permanently housed, not near enough. And it's expensive. It's permanent housing. But I think we are making some small strides.
Thank you.
Hey guys, thanks for working late for us tonight. When you say emergency shelters, what are the entities you're including for that?
Can we hit it? Okay. When I leave one out, Thomas can, or anybody else can chime in. So we have the emergency shelter for families. We have the men's emergency shelter. There's Austin's Place. Crisis Nursery counts as an emergency shelter. Courage okay. Connection, domestic violence, emergency shelter. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. And yes, this year we now, with this upcoming point in time, we now will have the emergency shelter beds with the runaway and homeless youth. They have historically been, when they were here, they were part of the count, and now they're back.
Okay, cool. Could you speak to the, because all of this is under the scope of the HUD's definition of homelessness, and could you speak to what HUD defines as homeless and what some of the things it leaves out from that in their definition?
So the HUD definition of homeless has a couple of different categories. The first category is literally homeless. Those are people who are in situations where they're living on the street or in places not meant for human habitation. So an example would be a parking garage in your abandoned building or something like that. Frequently there are vehicles. There's also category two, which is imminent risk for homeless. That's if they're within 14 days of losing their housing, which is not literally homeless, correct? The difference that you're asking, there's another federal definition through McKinney-Vento, which is in use by the Department of Education, potentially other departments, which includes people who are doubled up. That means people who are residing with other family members or other friends who are not literally homeless. They don't meet the HUD definition of homelessness. There are certain continuums that work with them. They have to seek specific permission from the HUD, and it's very, very rare. Yeah.
Also literally homeless is those fleeing domestic violence. So the designation, so really literally homeless are those HUD, when we say HUD homeless, Those are the individuals that are fleeing domestic violence and then living in places not meant for human habitation. Then there's the at-risk homeless definition. The HUD does have one of those. That is what Thomas talked about, when they literally in the next 14 days are going to be facing homelessness. McKinney-Vento is a broad definition that we all totally believe is a important thing to focus on, and we know that it's an issue. The schools use the McKinney-Vento, so when you hear the numbers from the schools, that is related to those that are doubled up, couch surfing. Oftentimes with the runaway and homeless youth programs, they also use the McKinney-Vento definition. When they are in runaway and homeless youth programs, they then are essentially grandfathered into HUD homeless definitions and open up doors for permanent supportive housing also.
Thank you.
I also put up here, Julian, the list of the individuals that are the entities.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Champaign County Healthcare Consumers.
Good evening. That's better. Sorry about that. My name is Claudia Lenhoff, and I'm the Executive Director of the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers. And I want to begin by saying that I am deeply grateful to the Mental Health Board for your funding of our two programs, the Community Health Worker Outreach and Benefits Enrollment Program, it's a mouthful, and the Justice Involved Community Health Worker Services and Benefits Program. And I apologize, I do not have a PowerPoint for y'all this evening, but I do have a presentation, and I put a packet of materials together for y'all. Although Healthcare Consumers is a new grantee of the Mental Health Board, we have actually been funded by the Mental Health Board for several years prior to this fiscal year as a sub-grantee of Rosecrans for our justice-involved work, which involves having one of our staff members work in the county jail to help people gain public benefits such as Medicaid coverage and SNAP or food stamps for when they're getting out. But this year is the first time that we have been directly funded. So I want to begin by explaining what we do as community health workers, or CHWs for short. This description of what we do applies to both of our programs that you fund. And after I explain what we do and how we go about it, I'll get into more specifics of the two programs. Our CHWs have specialized skills, and they are federally certified to help people apply for health insurance, including Medicaid, Medicaid managed care, marketplace plans, Medicare, Medicare Advantage, Medicare Part D, as well as the programs such as Extra Help and Medicare Savings that help make Medicare more affordable. As coverage options have expanded, the healthcare system is increasingly complicated, and the application process can be very daunting. Our CHWs have years of experience helping local consumers navigate these systems, and their skills are highly specialized. Most of the time when we are working with our clients, we use a case management approach. Even if the client comes to us just needing one thing, maybe they need to get to a certain kind of doctor, or they need health insurance, or they have a prescription that they can't afford, we will work with them to identify as many of their healthcare needs as possible. We take a broad view of health, so we assess our clients' needs for health insurance, healthcare access, prescriptions, food stamps, phones, etc. Then we systematically work with our clients to help complete the applications for services and public benefits and to ensure that they are getting access to the care and the prescriptions that they need. I have provided you with a packet of various materials that you can review at your leisure, but the first handout describes many of the services that we provide. The card that is on top, the little business card, is our client services card, which you might see at local pharmacies or at different organizations, and it's English on one side, Spanish on the other. This is just a quick, easy way to let people know that we're available to help. Although we are not a healthcare provider, I like to think of the work that we do as shepherding people through the complex systems and benefits that have to be brought together in order for someone to get the care that they need. Helping someone apply for Medicaid can be pretty straightforward. However, in Illinois, when one qualifies for Medicaid, one must then choose a Medicaid managed care plan. If you do not choose a plan, or if you don't get the mail that tells you to choose a plan, you will be auto-enrolled into a plan that may or may not work for you. There are some plans that have no providers in their network locally. Therefore, it's very important for us to work with our clients to choose a Medicaid managed care plan that meets their needs, including having the right providers, having the right prescriptions covered, and so on. But that's not the end of the story with a Medicaid application. All too often these days, Medicaid and SNAP as well, food stamps, unexpectedly drops the person's coverage, and then people don't know about it until a very bad moment. And that moment can be at the grocery store for food stamps, or it can be at the pharmacy when they go to refill their prescription, and then they get told that they don't have any insurance anymore. This will put people into a crisis, and it happens all the time because the state of Illinois' Medicaid eligibility system is very glitchy and problematic. We spend a lot of time dealing with that. Beyond doing applications for benefits and helping clients maintain their benefits, we also help link clients to the services that they need. We work directly with many of your other funded agencies, and we use the warm referral approach to helping our clients, to help us with trust building and ensuring that the referral works. As you all know, navigating the healthcare system, and especially mental and behavioral health systems, can be complicated, as availability of services can change based on the capacities of our local providers. It's our job to keep up with those changes and to update our materials. We have a mental health resource guide in the packet, and you'll see that we, you know, look at the mental health and behavioral health providers. We try to identify the ones that will serve low-income folks, whether on free services or sliding scale, or whether they accept Medicaid. And this information sometimes has to be updated on a monthly basis, depending what's happening in the community. All of that is to say that these systems are very complicated, and under the best of circumstances, most people need help. But people who are struggling with mental health or substance use issues often need extra help, and it is all the more important to ensure that they have continuous access to coverage, care, and prescriptions, and the support to be able to avail themselves of those services. But we don't just help people with applications and referrals. We are flexible, and we use a consumer empowerment approach to working with our clients. We have some clients who have very intensive needs and who need very time-consuming services from us to ensure that they are moving forward with getting their needs met. For example, we have some clients with whom we have almost daily or weekly contact for one reason or another. They might have a piece of mail that they don't understand, so they bring it to our office, or they've had an interaction with a provider that disturbed them for some reason, and they're seeking to understand it. I just got a text last Sunday night from a client who was very upset because when he went to the emergency room, he was sick, and he went to the emergency room, and his nose was swiped, and he didn't understand why. He knew enough to try to understand, so he reached out to me, and I spent time explaining that. But that's sometimes the kind of support that people need. They might have a problem that they cannot solve for themselves, so they come to us for help. I had another client who had a dental issue, and actually this client does have access to dental care, has a dentist, but in the moment could not think through the situation, tried to remove his own tooth in a very creative kind of way, ended up in worse condition. And so I had to counsel and advise that client to go to convenient care, get that resolved. When that was done, you know, then the client contacted me and was expressing feelings of hopelessness and all kinds of things like that. We made a plan, you know, we talked and we made a plan to see each other again. And the client came to the office the next day and, you know, we worked on dental issues, but also on, I helped the client to reestablish his counseling, his relationship with his counselor and go back to seeking services again. So sometimes our work involves going to medical or other appointments with our clients. Sometimes I have to go to township appointments with certain clients just to make sure everything goes smoothly, and to make sure that they get the most out of that appointment. In some cases, we are helping some clients apply for Social Security disability, but often in the course of providing practical services and case management for our clients, we are also providing emotional support, easing loneliness, and helping their providers or their loved ones better understand the challenges that the client might be facing. From some of the materials we have provided, you can see that our staff are bilingual and we can support clients who speak English and Spanish, and we try to make all of our materials available in both languages. So our CHW outreach and benefits enrollment program involves working with clients who are out in the community, whereas our justice-involved program works with clients who are in the county jail or who have recently left the county jail. In terms of the numbers, as of the second quarter, our CHW outreach and benefit enrollment program has served approximately 125 treatment plan clients. We define treatment, because we're not a clinical service provider, the way that we define treatment plan clients is these are the clients for whom we are doing applications, opening up a case file, doing case management, and so on. In the same period, we have served about 50 non-treatment plan clients, and these are clients who come to us with a simple need, using Mark Driscoll's description, sort of one and done. You know, it's just something simple, it's not intensive. They might come back later on and become a treatment plan client, but these can be phone calls or walk-ins. We have had about 35 community service events, which can include anything from speaking at an outreach event to let people know about resources and services, to one that I did at the request of Joel Sanders, Urbana Police Department, who had the audacity to ask me to come and present at 6 a.m. on 2 days in a row during shift change for the officers. But I gladly did it because I know a lot of times the officers are trying to resolve situations on the scene, and they might actually encounter people who will let them know that they haven't been able to get their prescription because they can't afford it or they don't have their insurance. And if so, you know, we told the officers they could just give the person our client services card and contact us. So we do things like that. We have also served about 20 clients in the category of other. For the most part, in our program, other refers to clients who need to use our prescription drug fund. We created a fund in our organization to help cover the cost of prescription drugs for individuals who could not afford them. Sometimes those costs are because the person has coverage, but they have multiple prescriptions and they couldn't afford the copays altogether. Other times it's because they found out that their Medicaid dropped out from under them and now they can't afford their prescription, but we want people to have continuity of their prescriptions so that they don't, you know, spiral or have problems. And so we've created this fund. I do want to tell you that I think going forward, our numbers may go down a little bit because Medicaid has implemented a new rule where they are no longer requiring certain copays, some of the low dollar copays for prescriptions and office visits and things like that. And so we may have fewer clients who need our prescription drug fund for that. But then the clients who do need it will probably be the higher dollar, you know, clients. So in terms of service contacts for this program, we have had approximately 590 service contacts during the first half of the year. Most treatment plan clients, as I described, have multiple contacts with us throughout the year. But as I described earlier, there are some clients who need very frequent contact with us, often with more than one staff member, and that drives up our service contacts number. I do appreciate that you request information about unique clients in terms of numbers, but that you also consider sort of volume of service in these service contacts, because I think that's one of the challenges for our organization is describing that, you know, when you help somebody apply for Medicaid, it's not just a one-time appointment once a year. There's a lot of work involved. And then for people who are struggling, you know, with mental health issues or substance use disorders, so on, they might require more appointments, smaller sized, you know, sort of appointments, just because there might be greater anxiety or inability to focus for very long or whatever it is. So I do appreciate that you let us measure the service contacts. I do believe that because we are new to this funding and the need to track our clients in a certain kind of way for y'all, we have undercounted the clients who we have served with both of our programs a little bit. It took us about the first quarter to really develop a consistent client tracking system for the purposes of meeting your reporting requirements, and I appreciate you, you know, letting us develop that system as we, you know, were being funded and providing the services. As you can see from the very last document in your packet, this document is our client services intake form. So this would be for our treatment clients, where we're opening a case file, and you can see the kind of information that we collect. We had been collecting a lot of it already, but we added new categories so that we could fulfill the reporting requirements for the mental health board contract. In addition, we have also we have Salesforce, which is a program that we use for tracking clients and the services that we provide to them, and so we've had to modify that as well. Okay, now switching gears to the Justice Involved CHW Services and Benefits Program. Again, this is the program that involves delivering the same kinds of services in the jail. Chris Garcia is our staff member who works in the jails. He receives referrals from Rosecrans staff who are in the jail, as well as the correctional officers in the jail, and sometimes just some self-referrals where somebody might have heard from somebody else about their work with Chris, and then they'll go and put in a request to meet with Chris. And Chris works with people to start their Medicaid applications. A lot of times the Medicaid application can be started but not completed when somebody is in the jail, because those applications require documentation, and a lot of times people don't bring, they don't have that kind of documentation on them when they are arrested and put in the jail. So Chris starts the process of working with people, and then a lot of times the process will have to continue once the person gets out. That's true for Medicaid and also food stamps. Almost anybody who we're applying for Medicaid, we're going to apply them for SNAP, for food stamps as well. The nice thing is that because people learn about Chris while they're in the jail, and they also know that he has some office hours, you know, at our office in downtown Champaign, a lot of times people, when they get out, they know that name or they've interacted with him, some trust has been built, and they will follow through and come back to the office and complete their applications. You know, there's not always a set time frame when they come back and do that. But one of the nice things, too, is that a lot of times they will bring family members as well or friends and create, you know, referrals for us and so on. But anyway, the numbers for this program are smaller, of course. The work is more fragmented because we are basically working with people who are in transition for the most part. The people who are serving a sentence in the jail, those are people who have a sentence of a year or less. A lot of times they don't want to do an application until it's closer to when their sentence is completed, because there's no point in it right now with the way the Medicaid system is. But otherwise, the people who are passing through the jail, a lot of times will start their application or want to start their application, but people don't always know when they're getting out. So the work is a little bit more fragmented, and so there's a little more work involved in tracking down people once we've started applications. So again, it's not unusual for clients from the jail to come to our office sometime after they have been released to meet with Chris. Some of these clients are offered access to mental health or substance use disorder treatment while they are in jail, but they might choose not to engage at that time. But sometimes, and it can be weeks or months later, the client who is working with Chris might begin to ask about those kinds of services. And then at that point, we can facilitate a referral. So the good thing is that by having services in the jail, whether it's Rosecrans's services or our services, people are learning about what's available for them when they go out into the community, and they can start the linkage in the jail. In terms of the numerical report for this program, we have served approximately 19 new treatment plan clients, 3 non-treatment plan clients, and we have about 40 service contacts. And it is possible that some of the treatment plan clients in our other more community-based program might be some people who came through the jail, but if they come to our office and they didn't specify Chris or specify that they had already started, applying in the jail, we might not know. So anyway, I will stop here, and I'm happy to answer any questions y'all might have.
I have a couple of questions. Do you intersect with the homeless issues we've just heard about?
Yes.
Do you refer? How does that work? Do you refer or?
So
to these people? Or?
Yes. A lot of us work together. We have a lot of clients who are, who stay at CU at Home, which is not far from where our office is located. They frequently come to us, for help with, Medicaid or prescriptions and things like that. So we serve a lot of homeless folk clients.
And my other question is, I was glad to see that on your intake form you have you go beyond Spanish and use translators, but do you find that literacy itself is an issue with your clients?
Yes, thank you. That is a very good point. Yes, for some clients, literacy is an issue. The client does not always disclose that. We can figure that out, working with the client. Sometimes it's actual literacy. Other times it's sort of health literacy or bureaucratic literacy. If you've ever gotten a notice from the state about your Medicaid benefits, or it's almost indecipherable unless you're used to reading that sort of thing. Yeah, and we will make notes about that. So if we find that we have a client who maybe is not very literate, and we'll ask them in what way they want us to communicate with them, whether texting or calling. And so we will do that. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you have other sources of funding?
We do. Our not specifically for this work, except, well, partially. We have funding from the City of Urbana. Their social services is grant funding. But, of course, that funding can only be used for the Urbana, for the portion of the Urbana clients that we serve. We do get some funding from Carl. We have some contracts. So we get some funding from OSF for a program for seniors. And then we do a lot of our own just grassroots fundraising. Yep.
Just seems to me like you do a tremendous amount. You say you're not a service provider, but you're a service provider. And you do a tremendous amount of coordination which is something that we've often worried about. And so it's great to hear again what you do.
Thank you. Actually, you know, many of the meetings that we are encouraged to attend or required to attend as part of the Mental Health Board funding actually really help to build those relationships and help increase the capability for referrals. And then, you know, I think there's a lot of people in this community who think that all the services and programs are in silos. You know, well, different organizations have different expertise. And just because you're an organization that has a certain expertise doesn't mean that you're in a silo, especially if you have this network and capability for referring. And so that's what we strive for, and so many of the organizations that you fund also strive for that as well. And I think we're all, you know, growing in those ways. But it's really important to not just give somebody a piece of paper and send them on their way. That's how people fall through the cracks. The other thing is that a lot of times, you know, we're working with people who it's not the best day of their life. They're having struggles. They just might not have the, you know, the ability, even if you tell them about an organization and the services and who to contact and all that, they just might not be able to follow through and make that phone call. So a lot of times it's just easier to do it when they're in our office, you know, with us.
Thanks for coming out tonight. Thanks, Elaine, for asking the question about literacy. I talk about this a lot. I noticed at my job, making things make sense to people is a huge deal. And lots of times when it's people with master's degrees who are sitting around coming up with documents, they don't think about how somebody who doesn't have a high school education is going to be able to pick through that. And I will say when it comes to medical documents, you don't need literacy issues to not be able to understand that. You mentioned earlier with the justice involved that sometimes it's people who have recently left. Now, do you have a way to contact people who have recently left, or is this people who have heard about you guys within the jail and are leaving and following up?
It's both. So sometimes if contact is established while the person is at the jail, Chris will try to get their contact information for when they get out. If they have it. Other times what happens is that when people are leaving the jail, the sheriff's office, the correctional staff, and Captain Vogus at the jail have been amazing at collaborating with Rosecrans and with us so that we can make this happen. But everybody who leaves gets a handout. And again, handouts aren't, you know, the only or best way of doing things, but if the handout reflects something that the person was exposed to while they were in the jail, like they saw the guy Chris who's helping people with their Medicaid, and then they see our name on the handout, then they might seek us out. So it's both. I do wish that we could have an easier way to follow everybody and just to make sure that, you know, if they need services, they know we're there. But so it's both.
But you're not able to get a list like the reentry program does with DOC?
No, not like that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the clients who are justice involved, who are seeking Medicaid, is there a common theme of what the medical needs are that they're trying to get the coverage for, or are they just in general just wanting to have health coverage?
I will probably have to follow up with you on that. I'm not sure that there's a common theme, except for maybe there's a prescription. So it might be for blood pressure. It might be that somebody, we have had clients who, upon going to the jail for the very first time, they might be getting a prescription from a psychiatrist, like an antidepressant or something like that. So a lot of times it's the prescription, or they do have something that has been, you know, bothering them, and it can be a physical ailment or something, or they had insurance before. And maybe they have other health needs, but they know they need to get insurance. So it's a variety of things. I will try to find out more and then include that in my next quarterly report. But from what I've seen, it just seems like a variety of things.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Okay. So John?
I just had a few questions. So With medications being expensive, and you guys do then help some of the people get or pay for their medications, do you have them talk to their doctor to see if there are cheaper alternatives? And do you look at websites like GoodRx.com to see if a certain pharmacy is cheaper, to see if an alternative is cheaper for them? Because even though, like, we like to think doctors know what the cheapest medication is, it is so complicated. Even if you prescribed mm-hmm. it all the time, one medication will be cheap for one insurance, like
right.
Molina, but then if you get IlinaCare, it's really expensive and not covered. And certain, like the capsule is covered, but the tablet is not.
Right.
And it changes every year, and mm-hmm. so it's really not easy for anyone to know what the price is unless the patient tells the doctor that this is expensive, is there something else?
Right. Yeah, so usually what we do, most of the people who come to us for prescription drug help, not all, but most, are insurable. In other words, they're not undocumented immigrants. They are insurable. So a lot of times we'll work with them to try to get them covered. But what we do is we work with two pharmacies. We have a collaboration with the OSF outpatient pharmacy, and then also with Schnucks Pharmacy in Urbana. And those pharmacies are really good at trying to help us find the cheapest price if we're paying the full cost of the medication. And they will apply the discount coupons and, you know, different things like that to try to try to do that. As far as the generics and stuff, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag because sometimes somebody really needs that name brand because they didn't do well on the generics. And so, but we kind of rely on the pharmacist to help us with that. And then the way that we sometimes make up the money, like, as you know, inhalers are just, they can be hundreds of dollars for one inhaler for 1 month. Those are the ones that really challenge us. Inhalers, psych meds, and eye drops are super expensive. And so a lot of times what we'll do is if the client is insurable through Medicaid, we'll go ahead and pay for the prescription so that they don't have to wait. The pharmacy bills us at the end of the month. Both of these pharmacies are very nice at, like, billing us at the end of the month. And then if we can get the person covered with Medicaid, you know, Medicaid has a look-back period. And then once the person's Medicaid kicks in, we can go back to the pharmacy, ask them to rebill that medication through Medicaid, and then they refund us what we paid, and then we take that money and put it back into our prescription drug fund. But yes, every situation is different. The easiest ones are the people who have been on the same prescription, and this is what works for them, and just maybe their Medicaid dropped out, and we just need to fix it.
Another question I had was, translator services can be expensive.
Mm-hmm.
How do you certify that someone can be a translator, and do you get help through, like, OSF for those resources, or how do you do that?
Well, in terms of, like, our Spanish language capabilities, we can do interpreting, and we can do this kind of writing. We do not serve as a medical interpreter, I know, like,
so
Carl has
their
medical interpreters,
so
and
it's
they
not the same standard. You don't have to worry about getting that certification.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, if it's medical interpreter, there really are requirements for that. Most of the clients we see, even if English is not their first language, and then Spanish isn't their main language, most have enough English, or we have a little bit of, you know, French and all that we can help with, and we can make it work, or they bring a family member who has more English. So that's, but yeah, it's a different standard.
Good to know. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank
all
you.
Right. Thank you very much. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Turn to page one and two.
Page one and two.
So is it application list?
It's funny we're that far into the book.
I know. So as you can see, I mean, just as you read along with it, whatever everybody's applied for and what they were extended for. Questions?
Yes, just to provide a little more context, we had, I believe, about 45 mental health or substance use disorder related applications. The list itself is both Mental Health Board as well as Developmental Disability Board. You'll see noted in the one of the center columns whether or not they were previously funded by the Mental Health Board or the Developmental Disabilities Board. We did have a couple of two new agencies that attempted to submit an application, but were not successful. One came closer than the other, and then so those they are on the list, but they did not actually get an application submitted. And then we had two existing agencies submit new applications, and all the rest are new applications. We have run into a cover authorization form issue with one existing entity, which I guess is something that staff is or that we've discussed, I guess.
It was a technical problem, so we can see that the application was completed, but there was a technical problem at the end of the process. So we thought we should present that as a completed application. It was tricky because there's another agency that had the same technical problem, but they were not as far along in the process. They actually missed a whole form. So this has been the hard rule for a few years. So we applied it like that. And then there was an agency that didn't apply at all that we were expecting an application from. So if you don't see a number, a dollar amount next to the in the PY21 column, that means that we didn't count that as an application for you to consider, and that's because it either wasn't submitted at all or it wasn't finished.
So with the multi-year contracts that were already approved, that substantially reduces the review that is asked of staff as well as the board. It'll make all our lives a little easier.
And in case it's the first thing on your mind, it's too early for us to give a projection about 2021 revenues. So I can't really tell you what the difference is between requested and what's likely to be available, but I have been playing around with different numbers. So someday soon I'll give you a guesstimate.
Sure.
We have a couple of new board members who don't know about this process, but in the last 3 years, the board has approached the applications in a different way than they used to. We do a pretty detailed, maybe too detailed, analysis of the applications. The applications are really complicated to start with, so you can all read all the applications. You can also all read the staff program summaries of all the applications. But what we've been doing is everybody, you kind of split them up and take responsibility for a set. And so we had a discussion last summer about maybe some changes to that process. I didn't feel like we really answered the question of whether we should do that process again. So it's up to you. If you choose to do that process again, I did make a couple of adjustments based on suggestions that were made in the summer about assigning to, sort of based on what people are interested in and splitting up the teams that had sort of been in place for 3 years. Like that was kind of getting old, and some of you were looking at the same programs over and over again. So anyway, so it's a question, but the applications are here if you're interested in that.
Any questions or comments about that?
deciding that, whether or not to do it this way or right now or? No.
No.
They're here for you today.
Yes. And we'll distribute that later.
Do you want me to distribute them now? Yeah. And they're great for the recycle bin if you don't want them.
Okay.
It's for the folks that way. All right. Well, I'll speak of it for a second. You know, Lynn and I spoke a little bit about this, and I said, you know, obviously there are some programs that I am more passionate about than others, and so I am comfortable with, you know, hey, I'll jump on this one and that one. But again, you know, I'm more than willing to read all 24, but I just wonder if we're better off to divide and conquer. So that's just my opinion.
I will not be reading all 24.
What you have, no. You have, there's a sheet which shows all of the assignments. Highlighted in yellow are proposed assignments for each of you. If your name is first, you're the primary reviewer. If your name is second, you're the backup person. Then the applications which are assigned to you are in the packet. And then there's also there's a template that Susan Fowler developed, if you want to do it this way. And that template document is also in there. It's like a checklist. There are some things that we as staff have like very easy access to information that you don't. So those things are taken off of that checklist so that you're not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead.
Now that we're talking about this, I think I've said this last year. I think eventually all of us should represent everything. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, each one so that we learn. But not only that, I would not like to see people get entrenched in a cause.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very good that I like, you know, that you assign to things that, mm-hmm. that we might be interested in. But in time, I think they need to switch around just for fairness and for us to learn.
Okay.
And for us to even have to advocate for something we're not interested in mm-hmm. and learn about it.
Go ahead, Jillian.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to agree with what you said, partly because what will happen, it's kind of like human nature. If you're getting the one, you're going to end up advocating for it. The job's not really to advocate, I don't think. I think the job is to describe it
yeah.
so everybody can come to some concrete judgment about what they think about it. So it would tend to put us in the position of advocating if mm-hmm. it's sort of, oh, this is mine.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to agree that yeah. we ought to rotate them around in
yeah.
some disorderly fashion, probably
mm-hmm.
random.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's that I have worked or volunteered for quite a few of his places, and so I feel very comfortable with them. Yes, however, I work at being fair in my reading of each packet.
Well, and I think it is good that, you know, there's a first reader, a second reader.
Mm-hmm.
So at least, you know, I can at least skim it, but I know that, you know, Julian and, you know,
mm-hmm.
Kyle are going to really hit the things that I might have missed. Because I'll be honest, I'm a working mom and 24 things. You're asking me to do a lot, but I'll do it.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? For the new folks, are you overwhelmed already? Not yet. Okay, good.
Maybe I missed this. This isn't all the applications that are how it is.
We're
2 years.
We're not reviewing the application. We're not reviewing anything that's extended for the term because you've already approved it for this year. We're also not asking you to look at very many DD related contracts, only the two that are related to early childhood, and that's based on your really specific priority around
that. So the list that's in the packet includes things that are part of the two-year thing that we're not going to be reviewing. Okay.
So in addition to, so yes, we also, staff will be reviewing everything, and we've already started on some of that. But I would also invite you to contact us, because I think that's been very helpful to us in the past, to have discussions with you about any application or any agency. And, you know, we can meet at the office. I can meet you all for coffee. That's very helpful to us.
You are continuing to give us your staff summaries, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Those are pretty helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're very helpful.
Okay.
So move it on. The Carl Foundation.
Yep. So this is a letter. This is a memorandum from the Deputy Director of Finance at the county. And you'll see the DD board is the last listed. Their developmental care, that's the name of that fund. Mental health is your fund. And you can see the listing there is $213,491. So what that is, that is money that's sitting in reserved fund balance. So we have not planned to spend it. We have planned to save it just in case this happens. So that amount will be pulled out of the account and returned to Carl Foundation at the end of March. And then the amount listed for DD, you know, same situation. It's all in a reserved fund balance. Then it's important to note this is for tax years 2005 to 2011 because there's other money that hasn't been decided yet. So what I can tell you about that from Tammy Ogden is that this is for four parcels. For Carl parcels, and they're still to be determined, are five other Carl parcels and presence. And so those findings could happen sort of quickly, and then those funds will need to be returned to Carl or presence. And I believe that the Mental Health Board and the DD Board have enough in reserved fund balance to do all of those repayments. It's possible that If we don't, there's a question that the county will be asking for its own funds, and that is whether current appropriations can be used to pay back these liabilities. So if we have to, the question's going to be answered anyway about how to do that. But right now it doesn't look like the current budget will be affected by this. So that's really all there is to say about it. I feel so lucky that we saved money. There's another amount I have on a chart, but I didn't have it in time to put in the board packet, and it's another amount that would be likely to go out shortly after this, and it still doesn't put us over what we have in reserve fund balance. So, okay. Yay us.
That's good.
Might be information that you're not privy to have, but, you know, obviously we planned ahead for this. Are there other agencies under the county who are like kind of scared right now?
If only there were a county board representative. I don't know if it's, I don't even know if this is information that you can share, but I don't have the information.
As far as reserves, so we don't, we have some put away, but not enough to cover the entire thing.
Okay, thank you.
No, we are in a very different position than everybody else because a majority of, like 90% of the DD fund goes to agency contracts. And so we have the ability to dial that down if we need to, if we see it coming. And I think for you it's more like 85%, 84%. But still, that's a lot of discretion to save money and not put it into the budget. So.
Okay. So, agency information. So, anyone? Any agency information out there? old business. Except Pat Aggie left.
Yeah, we have a short report, written report in the packet from Cunningham Children's Home related to their progress on implementing the new family model, ARC. She has also provided additional information about that specific model. I mean, the board discussed this back in November and approved it, but she's provided some additional detail. Our new members may find it of interest. One of the things Pat has been working towards is getting the training set up, and I believe she was going to talk a little bit about that, but they are interested in they have a training scheduled for late April, Thursday and Friday, I believe, April 23rd and 24th, a two-day training here on ARC, and is, I think, planning on soliciting input from the board as to whether any, I think probably would be limited to two board members, but if any board members are interested in participating in that, attending that training, it would be a two-day commitment. There is another one-day training that will be held either in May or June. That has not been scheduled yet, but I believe she's got an email that she wants to have sent out as far as soliciting board interest in attending the training. So.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So, financial assurances, is that Mark again?
That's me. I feel like there's literally nothing left to say. And
okay.
I jammed it all in that memo. So if you have questions, or if you have questions later, I mean, I could address them.
Okay. So a schedule as a location timeline, so on pages 29 to 33.
There's a date change that's important. Your meeting for July had been scheduled July 22nd, and we moved it to July 15th. I know that might not work for everybody, but this is about getting our budget stuff together in time for county deadlines. So sorry if that's inconvenient. But.
No. Any questions about the allocations and times apart from that? Move for approval of board meeting. Not yet. My bad.
Just they met this morning. They had roughly the same agenda. I did not give them that multiple page report on financial assurances because it's a little bit different situation for the DDB set of agencies. The thing they did that you don't have is this. There's this mini grant project that they're working on, and I gave them an update. It has been really challenging, so maybe you want to see that update sometime. But that's all.
Okay. The move to approve this a mental health board meeting, page 34 to 37. Second. Yeah, make a motion. So, roll. Kyle. Yes. Question to roll. Oh, okay. All in favor? Aye. staff reports on 38 to 46.
I just want to offer my regular compliment. Sometimes I forget to compliment Mark. I always find your report amazingly helpful. It kind of summarizes everything I need to pay attention to. I've gotten now in the habit of reading that before I read everything else. It really helps me understand what's going on. So thank you.
Anything else? Board to board reports? Yes, Elaine.
Yes, as usual, I went to the community coalition meeting, and there was a lot of talk, just a couple things. I mean, there was a lot of things, but there was a listing of partnerships and examples of them of the schools now with agencies helping families and children. So that was good to hear and something we need to keep in mind when we're looking at this big web. The trauma and resiliency people were talking about an infrastructure for dealing with helping families impacted by violence. It was, the language was a little bit new, talking about that and putting that together, or needing that we need to put an infrastructure for that. And the only other thing, though we don't fund them, the Fresh Start Program grant is running out, and so February 25th, there's going to be a city council study session on that program. Of course, it does kind of come in our purview in a way, if anybody is tracking that and wants to go to that.
Thank you. Any board announcements? Other business. So I move to go into closed session pursuant of 5 ILCS 12/2 C11 to consider litigation which is pending against or on behalf of Champaign County and litigation that is probable or imminent against or on behalf of Champaign County, and that the following parties remain present: Executive Director Lynn Canfield, Associate Director Mark Driscoll.
Second and a roll call.
Okay. Roll call. Yeah.
Mike, microphone probably for this.
Thank you. I should know better. Joe Omoasagie.
Yep.
Elaine Palencia.
Yes.
Kyle Patterson.
Yes.
Julian Rappaport.
Yes.
Jane Sprandel.
Yes.
Kathleen Couch.
Yes.
And John.
Due to potential conflict of interest because of my employer, I just want to make sure that we remain impartial, so I will be leaving this session.
Thanks, John.